It is said that when the Lumiere brothers first exhibited their film of a train entering a station, the audience fled in terror. So convincing was the illusion of reality they created. They really thought in that moment they were in danger of being hit by a speeding locomotive. Yes, illusion, it's what film's all about. It's something that has fascinated me since I was a child, and I first became aware of the world of cinema. Actually, if you're wondering all the background noises and things, I'm actually walking in the country. That was a pheasant you just heard flying off. I disturbed. I'm on a trail, heading toward an old Iron Age hill fort. But getting back to the point, cinema, illusion. It's always fascinated me, and fascinated me even more when I learned more about how films were made. I know for many people, once they learn how a film is made, that they're all studio sets and special effects, and they're just actors with people shouting instructions at them. For them, knowing that destroys the illusion, and they found it difficult to enjoy films. For me, it just made me enjoy them even more. Gave me an added marvel at how the makers of a film are able to perpetuate this illusion of reality, when in fact it's quite patently artifice. And it still does the same. Whenever I watch a film, rather than detract from my enjoyment of it, the knowledge that, say, like with those tight shots you get often in low-budget historical films, you know that if that camera was to move even a few inches to the left or the right, or to elevate slightly, you would see something anachronistic. You know, you'd see a modern car parked in what's meant to be like a 19th century London or something. And that fascinates me, the perpetuation of the illusion. Oh, hello. It's like me from the future. As you can gather, this is like the next day. As you can gather, I'm not on that trail at the moment. The long and the short of it is that listening back to what I recorded yesterday, realised there's sort of bits I didn't cover, some stuff didn't record properly, problems with the soundtrack. So, obviously, Dave, you can hear I'm on the beach. So I thought I'd take some time out and try and record the missing bits. I'm afraid in the course that you're going to have to put up with some switching between locations. Anyway, getting back to the subject in hand, the illusion of movie, of film. The thing, of course, which helps maintain the illusion of film is our willing suspension of disbelief as a viewer of that film, which essentially means we agree. We enter into an unspoken agreement with the filmmakers that for the duration of that film, you know, 2 hours, 90 minutes, whatever, we will accept that what we see on the screen before us is a representation of reality. We will treat it as if these are real events unfolding, even though we know they're not. But we accept that what we are seeing is reality. But from the other point of view, this agreement is dependent on the filmmaker staying within a certain set of rules or criteria of whatever genre of film they're making. If it's if we're talking about an historical film, say, set in Victorian London, then we agree, look, I believe this really is Victorian London, although obviously it can't be, but I believe it is Victorian London, as long as you don't do something, as long as I don't see, say, a red double-decker bus suddenly go past the entrance of that alleyway or something. That's what we're agreeing to. And as long as I don't step outside of this, we can maintain the illusion that this is real. But of course, the interesting thing is we have different tolerance levels for what will result in the breaking of this spell. Well, I mentioned there's a fairly obvious one about, you know, you see something that's obviously anachronistic in a historical film. For other genres, I don't know, for like a science fiction film, it might be something that's scientifically, you know, is scientifically absurd, scientifically wrong. That may affect your enjoyment of the film. Some as it doesn't. I mean, we have this threshold. As if, for instance, I'd say in Star Wars. I mean, I know that scientifically, sound cannot travel in a vacuum, so there would be no sound from all the explosions going off in space as the Death Star explodes, or as other spaceships are fired at. You wouldn't hear the sound of the weapons being fired or anything like that. I know that, but I'm still willing to suspend. That's a fairly minor point. I know that it's necessary for dramatic effect, and therefore I extend my willing suspension of disbelief to encompass that. Say, okay, I know it's not real, but I will ignore that for the time being and accept that this is otherwise real. But it can vary, of course. Say, a lot of it is dependent upon your personal knowledge as to how much you are willing to suspend your disbelief. And I'm back. Yeah, that's what I was saying. It depends on the genre of the movie. I would say supernatural films. I personally don't believe in the supernatural. I don't believe in the existence of ghosts or spirits of the dead. I don't really believe in the existence of vampires or werewolves. However, for the duration of a horror film, I am prepared to suspend my disbelief in these things and go along with it, because such things exist within the terms of reference of that genre and that film I'm watching. But I expect it to play fair within those rules as well. But then we're back to this question. What does it take to shatter the illusion, or to undermine the illusion that a film is presenting? I mean, a lot of people, for instance, science fiction films, if you're watching with people who aren't real science fiction fans, you complain that something in them is scientifically implausible and this is undermining the credibility of the film and your suspension of disbelief. They say, oh yes, but it's just a film. But the late John Brosnan, critic and writer, he wrote a very good book about the history of the science fiction film, which he explores this question. And he says, well, what if you apply the same thing to other genres? What if, say, you're watching John Wayne and the Searchers, and a Boeing 747 suddenly flies past in the background? Wouldn't that undermine the undermine the whole credibility of the film? It's no good then saying, oh, well, it's just a film, because that fatally undermines the whole suspension of disbelief you built up, that this is in the Old West, to us primitive Victorian technologies and so on. Whole thing's undermined. And it really is just a movie once you see that 747 fly past. So it really does depend a lot, the suspension of disbelief, on a lot of factors. I say, from the filmmaker's point of view, it's them playing by certain rules and certain conventions with the genre. And from the viewer's point of view, of course, it depends a lot on your own personal knowledge of the subject. I mean, I'll give you an example. I, for instance, am dreadful if I'm watching films which involve railways and depictions of vintage railways, you know, steam locomotives, because they invariably get it wrong. And unfortunately, because I know it's wrong, it does undermine some of my enjoyment of it. I remember a minor point, a minor example of this. I was watching a BBC adaptation of Tess of the D'Urbervilles once, and it was very good, very convincing period detail. Until, of course, there's a scene with the railway. And once they've actually got a locomotive that looks about the right sort of Victorian vintage pulling to the station and the right sort of carriages. Unfortunately, then it says SECR on the tender of the locomotive, which stood for South Eastern Chatham Railway. And I know that the South Eastern Chatham Railway didn't operate in the area that Hardy, Thomas Hardy, identifies as Wessex. There would have been the London and South Western Railway, because I live in that area. The LSWR. Now, okay, people say, oh, that's a minor point, but it was just jarring for me. And it did rather mar my enjoyment of the remainder of the broadcast. So I try and avoid things with trains in them. And friends try and avoid what? If there is a thing with the train, they try and avoid watching it with me if it's inevitable it's going to be watched, because they know what I'm going to come out and say. Oh, sorry, I'm going up some steep steps now. So I think I'm going to break off again. Of course, it doesn't have to be something like an historical inaccuracy or technical inaccuracy, which could get you to suspend, to break the illusion as far as suspension of disbelief is concerned. I mean, sometimes it could be things like, I don't know, incredibly wobbly and unconvincing sets, which are make obvious that they are simply flat sets. They're flats rather than three-dimensional objects. You know, poor lighting can do that in the film. Or if it's a horror film or science fiction film, a really bad monster that's so obviously a guy in a rubber suit, or I don't know, sometimes you can see the strings on the flying saucers or whatever, it just undermines the suspension of disbelief completely. Sometimes it's something even simpler than that. I'll confess here, I've seen quite a lot of romantic comedies simply because they star Sandra Bullock, because she's, I don't know, a little thing about Sandra Bullock. And one I watched was called Practical Magic, in which she and her sister, played by Nicole Kidman, are witches. Now, the film just didn't convince me. I had a real problem with it, basically, because I had no problem with the concept of witchcraft in it. I mean, I personally do not believe in the supernatural. I don't believe ghosts, the spirits of the dead, or anything like that. I don't believe vampires are real. I don't believe there's such a thing as real magic, or the powers of the occult, or all this. However, I am perfectly willing to suspend my disbelief the duration of, say, a horror film or a fantasy film like this. And for that duration, believe in these things, provided certain rules are kept and played to. However, with Practical Magic, my big problem was actually the casting, because there is no way I'm ever going to be able to suspend my disbelief enough to believe that Nicole Kidman and Sandra Bullock could ever be sisters. I'm sorry, that's just stupid. There's no way. I just don't believe it. And something as simple as casting actually can be a big factor in your willing suspension of disbelief, because some actors are just so unconvincing in roles. There's some actors, for instance, who just look and sound too modern to be convincing as, say, cowboys in films set in the Old West. Is an example, but there you go. You see, but there's lots of things, as I was saying, which can undermine your suspension of disbelief.
Okay, I've cleared those steps. I'm up on the hill fort itself now. Sign there: ground nesting birds. Please keep to the footpath. In all the years I've been up here, I've never seen any ground nesting birds at all. But then I've stuck to the footpath. Right. I was talking last night about personal reasons. Personal knowledge can undermine your suspension of disbelief when watching a film. Another genre of film that it's hell for people to sit through with me to watch are war movies, World War II movies. Oh dear, it's one of my pet subjects. The wrongness of tanks and World War II movies. Very rarely get them right. There's good reasons for that, of course, but particularly German tanks, because obviously hardly any actually survived the war intact. and those that do are museum pieces now, whereas lots of Sherman tanks survive. But that said, most war movies, particularly ones made in the 60s, early 70s, didn't even use Sherman tanks to represent Allied tanks. Oh no. They're always post-war US types of tanks turn up, pretending to be sort of generic American or German tanks in films. There's a film in the 60s, Battle of the Bulge, you've probably seen it. Like many war movies of that era, it was shot mainly in Spain, because you could hire the entire Spanish army in those days to reenact the war which they didn't take part in. You know, some were dressed in German uniforms, others in American or British uniforms, and they reenact these battles with their tanks painted appropriately. Battle of the Bulge, I find unwatchable for several reasons. One is it's historically inaccurate. That's another very good reason which can undermine your suspension of disbelief. I mean, the whole Battle of the Bulge is fought in freezing cold Arctic conditions, and whilst the film shows the German offensive starting on the snow quickly vanishes from the film. They appear to be, and also it took place in the Ardennes forest, implies there might be trees. Well, later on they appear to be fighting on a vast plain with no snow in sight. They also fictionalise or change all the names, which undermines it completely. But what really bothers me in it are the tanks, you know. You guessed it. The Germans have these M47s painted grey with crosses on, and they keep calling them Tiger tanks. They look nothing like a Tiger tank. Ignores the fact also the Germans use a lot more different types of tanks than Tiger tanks. They only actually built about 3,000 Tiger tanks of both types. There you go, historical fact there for you. And the Americans tool around in M24s, which to be fair was a tank that saw service in World War II, but it was a light tank, and they keep calling them Shermans. And the Sherman's such a distinctive looking tank, you know, they're not the same thing. And it really bothers me. Yeah. It's one of the things in that film that really bothers me. I think it's on top of all the other historical accuracies. It just gets to me. I do find it unwatchable. Yet interestingly, the problem of the tanks doesn't necessarily have to undermine my willing suspension of disbelief. Another film made a few years later, also mainly shot in Spain, is Patton, George C. Scott, which is actually one of my favourite war movies. Fantastic film, but it suffers from the same problems in terms of tanks. Okay, by this time, it was made a few years later, the Germans have upgraded to M48s, and the Americans many have M41s. And we Brits in it have the M24s, all suitably repainted. And yeah, it doesn't bother me as much, partly because there's more historical fidelity in it. And the Battle of the Bulge sequence, for instance, are filmed on many of the same locations they used for the film The Battle of the Bulge, yet it's always snowy and it looks freezing cold and Arctic, and it's good. But the reason they don't bother me as much, the tanks in this one, is because they aren't foregrounding them. In Battle of the Bulge, they foreground all the military hardware because the characterizations are so weak and perfunctory. Whereas in Patton, the hardware and the battle scenes, and the battle scenes in Patton are magnificently choreographed on a huge scale. They are very much background, because the film isn't about that. It's a character study, ultimately, of a man who is obsessed by and lives for war, in the form of Patton. He's constantly at war. It's the state he lives in. It's not just a job for him, it's a whole state of mind. And as such, it's a magnificent film. And I can suspend my disbelief with all the other aspects of it. So, there you go, you see. It's possible to overcome these things. Whew, but I mentioned the historical inaccuracies. Again, needn't be a hurdle to suspension of disbelief, even if you know it's wrong. Because again, it's like Patton, it depends what the film is about. Is it actually telling you something broader? Take as an example, going back to John Ford, My Darling Clementine is quite possibly the most historically inaccurate reenactment of the whole gunfight of the OK Corral, Wyatt Earp and Clanton's and Doc Holliday business I have ever seen. However, it is one of the most dramatically satisfying tellings of this story. And as such, I have no problem watching it and immersing myself in it when I watch it. Because, of course, it's not really about simply the Earps and the Clantons and the gunfight and the historical aspect. It's a tale that John Ford is telling us, which has wider implications. It's a wider story about the taming of the West and how civilized values become entrenched as the West becomes more urbanized, as larger settlements appear. I'm on an uphill stretch again as I'm walking around the perimeter. I'm walking on the ramparts at the moment of this hill fort. There is a magnificent view from up here, there really is. It's fantastic. I mean, we've been having some very nice weather lately. Typically, as soon as I take a day off work, and there's the double bank holiday of the Queen's Diamond Jubilee coming up, of course, it starts cooling down. That said, whilst it's grey and overcast today, it's still stiflingly hot, which I'm not complaining about.
Okay, as you can probably hear now, I've moved away from the area of the beach where everybody is, the children playing and all that. I mean, this is, I should add, where I am. This is actually Leap Beach, which is down on the New Forest coast in the south of England. I'm up in the area now, there's all these huge bits of concrete and whatever on the beach. A bit difficult to describe, but long and short of it is, if you're familiar with the whole D-Day landings back in 1944, I remember they had after the D-Day landings, they had the Mulberry Harbours, these floating harbours that they towed across the channel. And used rather, so they didn't actually have to capture like a port town with a natural harbour. These were like these artificial harbours they built, sort of like landing piers. Anyway, they're called Mulberry Harbours. This is actually where they were built, on this beach. And the concrete blocks that are left here, these big concrete structures, are actually the bases upon which they were constructed. And there used to be a set of rails beside them, which they were slid down into the sea, so they could be launched, so they'd be towed off. And also here you can see some other bits of concrete and bits of a concrete causeway that goes down into the sea. That's where, I mean, there's photographs, you can see it. They tied up tank landing craft, and tanks were actually loaded onto them. A large part of the invasion fleet was actually assembled in this area between here and the Isle of Wight, which is just, I can see, just across the Soviet. Anyway, why am I telling this? What has this got to do with illusion? Well, it puts me in mind of the fact that D-Day involved the perpetration of a massive illusion on the Germans. Basically convinced German intelligence, of course, that there was, in actual fact, there was a huge military build-up going on over in East Anglia, that we were going to launch an attack from there, the Allies, to further up the north of France, Pas-de-Calais area, rather than in Normandy, where we did in fact launch the invasion and do this. A whole fake army was created, you know, cardboard cutout tanks and things, and then General Patton was deployed there to wander around and look as if he was inspecting troops and whatever, to try and deceive German intelligence into believing that this is where it was happening. Which puts me in mind, it's rather like a conjuring trick, of course. And that in turn made me think, of course, that the whole business of the suspension of disbelief whilst watching a film is rather like the same sort of thing we do when we watch a stage magician or a conjurer. Because we know they're not really doing magic, there's no such thing as real magic. We know it's a trick. But we suspend disbelief. Well, you don't sort of shout at them, you can't do magic, mate, you're not really Harry Potter. That's just some trick, some sleight of hand. We accept it. We accept this is just trick, and for the time we're watching them, although we know it's a trick, at the same time we pretend we don't know it's a trick. Yeah. They create this illusion, and we enjoy the illusion. And because, of course, we're complicit in it, because we want to believe, really, that it's some kind of illusion, that we're so clever that we're not going to be fooled by a simple piece of trickery. It must be more complex. The whole film explores it, The Prestige. And so it was, of course, with D-Day and the Germans, because they actually wanted to believe the invasion would take place in Pas-de-Calais, not in Normandy. And so it played into their own sort of desires there. It's something they wanted to believe, and we fed that belief. And so it is again with film, you know, because really we want to believe in what we're seeing, and so we're complicit in the illusion, as I say. And we do our best to suppress and put out of our minds anything, any sort of discrepancies and anachronisms and things that might destroy that illusion. Although, as I say, eventually there comes a point sometimes you can't ignore them, and your entire suspension of disbelief is destroyed, and the illusion is shattered.
Okay, well, I'm up on the top of the hill for now, the bit where the actual settlement used to be. There's lots of what they call tumuli up here, which are the sort of remnants of where buildings were, and some of them were at a later stage people were buried. It's a fantastic view from up here. This is the highest point for many, many miles. Being south of here, the ground begins to slope away down towards the coast, which is what, about, I don't know, 20, 25 miles from here. On a very clear day, you can actually see the coastline. You can see the Isle of Wight and Fawley Oil Refinery, but unfortunately today, you can't. It's cloud is far too low. It used to also, if you looked in the other direction, which I'm doing now, you used also to be able to see the aerial towers from HMS Mercury, which is was a landlocked ship, so to speak. It's a naval base up here. You know, landlocked. It used to be the Navy Communications Centre, but closed a long time ago. It was derelict for many years, and last time I drove past it, had been demolished. And doubtless they'll probably put up houses as flats or something there. But there you go. Getting back to illusions. And the whole business is suspension of disbelief. As I say, we're saying we want to be deceived, if that's the right word, by these illusions. We want to be drawn in by them. And that's the whole thing, that we are somehow complicit in the illusion because we want it to happen. So we don't think of ourselves being fooled. We're not being deceived as such because we want this to happen. As I say, it's always fascinated me since a very early age. I mean, do it whatever we're doing. I mean, when you read a book, obviously, you conjure up a mental picture, and there you're creating an illusion as well, and drawing yourself into it from the words on the page is translated into illusion. But as a child, what fascinated me, of course, the film takes to another stage. It's trying to make that mental picture you then conjure up from the words into something more solid and real looking, and that's always fascinated me in the process of illusion. It becomes a shared illusion that other people can share it. I mean, when you read a book, you see it in your own mind's eye, and you know that everybody else who reads that book, if you're reading it aloud, is having a different perception of those words and visual terms in their minds. Whereas, with a film, we all, I assume, see the same image, hear the same words spoken. Yet we can still all interpret it differently. And we all have different reactions to it, as I say, according to different factors as to whether the level of our suspension of disbelief in it. So, sorry, I keep pausing because I'm at a junction of paths. Pick a way to go. Let's go this way. I know where this goes. So, yes. The art of illusion. As I say, it's not just cinema. Cinema happens to things, as I say, which is fascinating since as a child. It's this fascinating world of illusion, and indeed it's been that way since the birth of cinema. I mentioned at the beginning, Lumiere brothers, and of course another early pioneer filmmaker was Georges Méliès, who brought all the sort of stage tricks to bear on film with his magnificent films he made, you know, about trips to the moon and whatever. And there's a case of suspension of disbelief. The tricks and special effects he used were obviously derived from stage devices, and in no way could be said to be to look realistic. And yet, that doesn't make them any less magnificent. And it doesn't discourage us any to any great degree to have a lesser suspension of disbelief in them. We watch them, accept them for what they are. We still believe in the film, but in a slightly different way, perhaps. Because we have to assume, even when they're first shown, audiences didn't believe in those special effects, the Méliès special effects they saw, like in when they tripped to the moon and everything. The projectile fired from the Jules Verne type big gun gets stuck in the eye of the man in the moon, that sort of thing. But one assumes they accepted them in the same way as I'm saying we accept stage conjurers now. We know it's a trick, it's just a case of how is it done. And secretly, there's a little bit of us wants to believe in it. Oop, it's going to the gate. So I'm just leaving the Hillfoot area now, heading back on the easygoing trail to the car park. And I tell you, if this is the easygoing trail, I'd hate to see the difficult one. Whew. But, so you're probably asking yourselves, what on earth has this Hillfoot got to do? Why am I recording this wandering around a Hillfoot? But this is part of the world of illusion, isn't it? Because, well, as I say, from an early age, fascinated by film. As I grew older, I became interested in that halfway house between, say, our reading something and imagining it and seeing it on a cinema screen, which is, of course, the world of audio and radio, radio dramas, radio comedies, where they paint a picture in words. Which, in a way, is one of the things I've been hoping to do. Show my traipsing around today, because it's that halfway house, because you don't have the visual element. Now, that's always the disadvantage of watching a film, say, especially an adaptation of a book, is it's imposing someone else's view, perception of it, on you. Whereas with audio, of course, you can create something of a picture, judicious use of sound effects to create an ambiance, and judicious use of words to describe things briefly. Whew. And again, like film, it's another illusion one is complicit in. Whew. Sorry, it's no good. I'm going to have to break off. So I think it's going to start raining. So break this off and pick it up again. Actually, I'm going to the beach, planning to go to the beach tomorrow, so maybe I'll pick this up again if we've got time on the beach tomorrow. But in audio, of course, the illusion is even easier to create and sustain than it is in film, particularly with, let's say, the willing complicity of the listener. I mean, you throw in a few sound effects or whatever, you could be anywhere. I mean, as I say, it's even easier than in film. In film, you can create the illusion. I mean, in film, you do it all the time. Films are allegedly set in places, and they're actually filmed somewhere else. And unless you actually have personal knowledge of that place, you're never going to know the difference. I mean, the film was American Gangster. Ridley Scott directed it. Denzel Washington, Russell Crowe in it. It's meant to be set in New York. I've been told that apparently it's filmed in New Jersey, in parts of New Jersey, and I'm told by people who live in that part of the world that it's quite obvious if you live in New Jersey, or even if you live in New York, that it's not New York. But to the vast majority of the world who don't live in either New Jersey or New York, we don't know the difference. As long as it looks like vaguely like New York, because we have an idea of what New York looks like, that's good enough. Because we're really just interested in watching the film. The fact that it's not really set where it says it's set isn't a big problem to us, as long as it looks sort of like it.
and effects easily create that illusion. You know, you could even have a film that's meant to be set in, say, New York, and you could film it in London. You know, you just find a building that looks suitably like somewhere in New York, you stick a Chevy Caprice painted like a yellow cab within the shop and whatever, get a couple of guys who look stereotypically American, I don't know, eating bagels or something, and this is our stereotypical idea of New Yorkers, and you have them in the background, and film it with your actors with what we think are New York accents, and you're away. To us in the UK, that's good, that's convincing. It's good enough. Yeah, and again, does it matter that it's not really where it's claiming to be? Because it's all part of the illusion. We want to believe it's New York, that's good enough. And as it's becoming increasingly obvious to you what I'm working up to here, have you ever seen F for Fake? Orson Welles' film, I think it's the last film he had made that ever actually got a cinematic distribution in the early 70s. One of the best films ever made on the whole subject of fakery and illusion in film. Anyway, you'll remember, if you've seen it, at the beginning of the film, Orson Welles tells us, "For the next hour, I will tell you no lies. I will speak only the truth." And towards the end of the film, he reminds of this, but then says, "But that hour was up nearly 20 minutes ago. And for those last 20 minutes, I've been lying my head off." As I think it's fairly obvious to you, for a large part of this little contribution I've recorded, I've been lying my head off in that one of the two locations I claim to be at. I'm clearly not at. It's not real. And it's fairly obviously here on the beach. It's not a beach. It's my living room. Just with the surreptitious use of a few sound effects, background sounds. I've created an illusion for a while. I hasten to add, the beach I claim I'm on does exist. Leek Beach is a real place. It is indeed the place where they built the Mulberry Harbours for D-Day. Also, the hill fort among the other sequels, that is real. I was actually there when I recorded them. It's a real place called Old Winchester Hill Fort. Nowhere near Winchester, but it's called Old Winchester Hill Fort. If you are at all curious on what either of those places look like, if you look at my nom d'unette, Doc Sleaze, if you put it in is one word, Doc Sleaze, into YouTube for search, it should bring up some films I've made in the past, and there's several films there. There's a fairly recent one from last year called On the Trail, which actually covers most of the ground I walked across on the hill fort, and there's another one called Breaking Waves, which is one I filmed at Leek Beach, and there's a couple of others I filmed at Leek Beach, older than that, if you're at all interested. There's the proof that these things exist, and indeed that I exist, because I actually appear in at least one of them. But there you go, that's my point, really. Illusion, there you go. Does it really matter? I mean, that's the whole point of illusion, isn't it? It doesn't really matter whether or not we are where we are, where we claim to be. And but as far as this bit of audio is concerned, whether or not you believed in either location depends upon your willing suspension of disbelief, whether you wanted to believe that's on the hill fort or on the beach. And that's really what illusion's all about. That's how it all works, because we're complicit in it. We want to be deceived. We want to believe in it. So there you go. That's my thoughts on illusion. And you know, till the next time, folks. I was Doc Sleaze in this, and, well, like I say, to the next... Oh,